And you got to keep fighting the feeling, the doom and gloom feeling. The doom and gloom feeling. And you got to keep fighting the feeling. Doom and gloom feeling.
Hello and welcome to episode 101 of It's Never Sunny in Seattle, a Seattle Mariners baseball podcast where fighting that doom and gloom feeling has never been more important. I'm not cut out for this. I'm Mike Yahedo. Dustin is not here, obviously. Day is not here as well. But joining us today is our former host, Anders Jorstad of Lookout Landing and Meet at the Mitt. Welcome back, Anders.
Thank you. It's good to be back in front of the old microphone. And you seem in very high spirits for a very dour offseason.
I think part of that is because we haven't talked over the offseason.
You've just been ruminating on all your feelings. I feel like that's even worse.
Yeah. I've been wanting to talk ball, but it has been, I was going to say, extremely busy since like August or maybe September, but really it's been busy for me since like June or July. So I think the boys were wanting a bit of a break, and Dustin I don't know if he's gotten engaged since we've recorded last, but like is getting married and stuff. You yourself have gotten engaged. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, that was a November thing. It was wild because I remember like very strangely like what was happening in like the Mariners world when that was happening. And I'm glad that that like took my mind off all the very sad things, because like that happened kind of around the Eugenio trade and the Kelenic trade. Now it's just like Mariners was just like a very bad place to be in. And so I'm glad that I had that to take my mind off things.
If you don't have Eugenio, at least you have your partner.
You want to hear a funny story about Eugenio? Just like, I know that we are not going to get into the moves yet, yeah. But my mom, so you know, the holiday season was happening as it often does, and it was like November. And my mom texted me and she asked me who my favorite baseball players were, and I gave her like, well, my favorite players around the league are Ohtani and Soto, but my favorite Mariners are Eugenio, and I think I said like Brian Wu or Matt Brash or something. And then, you know, a couple hours pass and the Eugenio trade drops, and I have to like go back and text my mom, and I was like, hey, so like if you were gonna get me a Christmas gift around Eugenio Suarez, you should know that he was just traded.
No.
And sure enough, like, she didn't say anything. She just, like, laughed. And then sure enough, when the holidays came around, she had gotten me a Eugenio Suarez signed baseball. And she's like, in the 1 hour between you giving me your player and, like, the trade happening, I got you this. And I was like, you know what? I think it's great because I still love him, even if he's gone. But it was just a funny slash sad, like, moment in my life.
That's so sweet, though. Yeah, that's such a kind gift.
Yeah. It is, like, in retrospect, I'm glad I have it because it's something to, like, remember him by. And, like, God, I'm going to miss that guy. That is, I know that we're not talking about that yet, but I'm just so, like, sad, like, emotionally sad about him not being a Mariner.
We were talking about this, like, 2 minutes ago before we started recording, but there are, you know, I think that this is a pretty high-level podcast analytically for, you know.
Wow. Brag about it.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, more than most. And yet, I think there are a lot of people. I'll say this. I guarantee you someone is going to listen to this and not know that Eugenio Suarez is not on the Mariners.
And I'm sorry that I had to break that to them. I really am, because I was very, like, I was just not happy when that happened. I will say, I was talking to my sister over the phone. She lives in Wrigleyville, and by nature, she is a Cubs fan, you know. But she admittedly is, like, a casual Cubs fan. And I was talking to her about, like, oh, did you hear about the Cubs, like, new pitcher they just signed, Shota Imanaga? She's like, I've not heard of that person ever in my life. And this is someone who, like, you know, she is a baseball fan. She played collegiate D1 softball. And she, like, she could probably tell you about the players that are on the team, like, especially the ones that have been there for a while, but she just, like, does not pay attention to the offseason minutia. And I said to her, I was like, You know, I actually do think it would probably be better for, like, my mental health if I just, like, came to, like, March and, like, spring training rolls around and I'm just, like, finding out what they did in the last few months and, like, not spending so much emotional energy on, like, every little thing the Mariners do from November to February. And yet I am scrolling Twitter endlessly on the barest of rumors because Hector Gomez said the Mariners are still in on Jorge Soler. And now I have decided to dedicate hours of mental energy just thinking about if the Mariners sign Jorge Soler, where could they play him? And I just don't need to do that with my life. But then she was like, yeah, but you're probably getting like a certain kind of like rush and joy out of that that is like elemental to your fan experience. And I was like, you know what? I think that's right. And that justifies me being a sicko.
But I was going to say the translation is you're sick in the head, King. So
as usual.
So, okay. That's, yeah. I think before we kind of get into the meat, we're going to start with some mailbag questions, which I think is new since you were a host on the pod, but obviously you listen. Just some housekeeping items. You can join our Discord. We usually post a Discord link in the show notes, as well as when the show goes out on Twitter, we'll send out a link there as well. Sorry about my voice, by the way. Also, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/neversunnyinseattle. I think last things are, I mean, this is forever ago. But thanks so much to everyone for the birthday fundraiser contributions. Raised over $1,000 towards...
heck yeah.
Yeah, Anakbayan in Seattle. As well as to contribute to the Kapit Bisig Solidarity Tour for Bayan. And I guess for my chapter, like that, those funds helped us mobilize to San Francisco to demonstrate against APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. And then I got a little cut out of it. So helping me sustain my... my basic needs. So thank you all so much. Just sent out the raffle for that. So if you haven't been reached out to, which no one on this pod won, then you haven't won. yeah. And then last thing, I think this is kind of a weird way to announce it, but we are kind of shifting the pod rotation. Anders is not joining us. It's just me and Dustin now because Day is too busy. I'm sure that he'll come on as a guest plenty often, but life calls. Okay, last thing is that with the active genocide that is happening in Palestine and with everything that is happening in Yemen right now as well, there's a lot of actions that are happening. Every Saturday at Westlake, there are Palestinian organizers that are setting up actions to really march and rally for Palestine. So we'll post more about that, but please reach out if you're interested. I'm sure I'll talk about it more. Durs, I think you should pick a mailbag question because I don't know that we'll get to all of these, and I think they'll be kind of embedded within the show, but you are the guest.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let's start with, I think this is a good one to start with, which is from JLim. They ask why we keep trading with the Rays. And just FYI, in case you're listening to this and you are like my sister and you just like don't know what the Mariners had done this offseason, the Mariners did make a trade with the Rays a couple weeks ago, or maybe even last week. They traded Jose Caballero for Luke Rayleigh, which is like one of just dozens of trades the Mariners have made with the Rays, which is funny because I don't think any of those trades have worked out like super well for the Mariners. I don't think any of them have necessarily come back to bite Seattle, but they've just kind of been swapping like tier three, tier four players back and forth largely. And I think it's justified to ask why. Jared Aputo himself has kind of said that he just works well with those guys. Like, I think that they just kind of like talk the same baseball language. I think that if you've been in like a fantasy baseball league before or a fantasy football league before, you probably know the experience of like there's just one or two people in your league that you just talk well with and that you communicate well with, and you think that you guys have similar understanding of like how players are valued. I think that's kind of where Jerry DePoto is with the Rays player, the Rays people, is that he just has an open line of communication. They tend to, you know, have a pretty good relationship, and they view players somewhat similarly, but differently enough that they can line up for all these trades where they kind of are fishing in the same pond, and they'll see a guy that the other team has and they'll be like, oh, well, I like what you did with that guy. Let's, you know, what would it take for us to get him? I think that's kind of what's going on with those two clubs, but I don't know if you have any greater insight or thoughts on that, Mikey.
Yeah, I think people tend to have the, I don't know if you remember that Sam Miller tweet, kind of reaction where it's like, oh, love this trade for the Rays. Who'd they get and who'd they give up, you know?
Right.
And it's like, you know, the Rays are smart, but it's not like they don't miss. Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it has to do with, I think DePoto is probably the most, or one of the most active, and I should just say the front office, one of the most active and one of the most frank, because DePoto has said openly, I think this is on the Cespedes Barbecue podcast, but the Barbacast was basically like, you know, we give people pretty straight up offers, and we're not, you know, actively trying to fleece anyone. We're just trying to make deals that we think work for everyone. And I think given that the two teams are operating under different constraints, I think it just, it makes for, you know, trade discussions that are fruitful. And I think the more that you have them, the more it strengthens that as well. So I don't know. I'm a little... again, like, I don't know if we get into it now, if we get into it later, but
let's go for it, because I do think some of these questions also require a little bit of context from the discussion that would bear out from these transactions.
Yeah, so I think just first, Robert Orr, who, if you don't follow him at BP, you should follow him before he gets hired by a team. He's one of my good homies. He's constantly writing really, really great theoretical and also, you know, not theoretical stuff, but just posted a leaderboard of Jose Caballero next to Isak Paredes. I mean, Caballero has a damage rate, which is, I don't know quite how to explain it, but maybe think of it like barrel rate until I can go look it up with a more kind of concise definition. It's better than his, and they have pretty similar traits. Rob also came up with a metric called Seager, like in all caps, and they're identical. So across the board, you know, the Rays are the one that made Isak Paredes break out. Kind of feels like they're going to do that again. Caballero is someone who really pulls the ball in the air. So that's kind of the initial impression there, is I think they're gonna be able to do something with him. He also plays second, yeah, and shortstop pretty well. So I think he's gonna like maybe hit a little more. I think the flip side of that is like he didn't hit in the second half of the season.
I think I kind of push back against the notion that he's necessarily going to break out. I'm guessing what you're saying is like he has the potential to break out, correct?
I don't think it's gonna be like a huge breakout. I just think that they're gonna get the most out of him.
Yeah, that's probably true. It's interesting because, you know, if we're going to start talking about the moves themselves, Caballero is one of those players I thought was very expendable for the Mariners because they have a million people right now who kind of are fitting that role. When you think about the Dylan Moore, Sam Haggerty, Ryan Bliss, like Jose Caballero, to me, for the Mariners, is almost like he was extra. I don't think he was going to start the season in the big leagues. And in the same realm, I think that's kind of where Luke Raley found himself with Tampa, because Tampa loves to mix and match positions. You know, everyone plays four different positions there, but I think he was going to get squeezed out of a spot there. I think that's kind of why that trade manifested, is because the Mariners are like, we need someone who can play outfield, who can maybe start, who can back up France at first base if he stinks, or back up DH if Garver gets hurt, and we don't need Jose Caballero because we have three other players who can fill that role. And the Rays were maybe like, I'm willing to do that because, to your point, I see something in Jose Caballero's profile that we think we can unlock. Maybe he will probably start out as a super utility guy if he breaks camp for Tampa, but maybe he has a chance to become their everyday shortstop.
Yeah, and I just pulled up the numbers because, like I said, like he did not do well in the second half. 8% above average by WRC plus in the first half, so 108 WRC plus, 76 in the second half, and that came with a K percentage that jumped from 21% to 28%, and a walk percentage that halved from 12% to 6%. So,
and to be fair, the same thing happened to Luke Rayleigh last year.
Oh, I haven't looked at his splits yet.
Yeah, he really dipped off in the second half as well. So it's interesting that they kind of both have the same, you know, profile in that sense. His like August and also his September were just like not good. He had a 155 WRC plus in the first half and a 93 in the second half. And his K percentage went up by 3 points. Well, pretty much the whole season he was running like a 30% K rate. But he definitely had a dip off in production as the year went.
Yeah. Yeah.
His ISO specifically went way down.
155 WRC plus to 93. So yeah, I think it's an interesting, I don't know if I'd call it a challenge trade per se. I think you're right that both teams like didn't necessarily need either player, and they're getting players that I think better fit their needs. And I think anytime, you know, from our perspective, that you have a Caballero, you trade him and you try and trade him for someone that can hit.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. It's going to come down to power for Caballero, and I guess the K rate, since it's elevated now, because his ISO is like 70, 80 points below average. I actually think his slugging is lower than his on-base percentage. If they can get that up to average, he's going to be a pretty good hitter. But regardless, you know, he's versatile and he can field the middle infield. So I think continuing with Rayleigh, what would you guess? And I don't know if you have like a frame of reference for this metric, but what would you think his swinging strike percentage is?
You're right. I don't necessarily have a frame of reference for this metric. Can you tell me what average is?
I think that it would be in the mid-10s. One rule of thumb, and it's very like, especially for pitchers, it doesn't work well. I actually don't know if you're supposed to use it for hitters and pitchers, but I do. Is that if you double your swinging strike percentage, you get your K percentage.
Oh, interesting. So his expected swinging strike percentage would be like 15% or so.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that.
I'm going to guess that his swinging strike percentage was like 17 to 18%.
Yeah, it's 20.3.
Oh my God.
And it's interesting because his chase percentage isn't like extraordinarily high. Like I was looking last night, I think average is like 28%. His is like 30 or 31%. Like,
right.
You know, he expands the zone a little bit, but like, first of all, some hitters actually like their sweet spot can be, you know, maybe like low and away out of the zone. So he doesn't chase like extraordinarily, you know, high, but his zone contact is really low. So I think that is to say, like, it's not a pitch selection thing per se, but he's swinging through pitches, which is not, you know, it's like not ideal. So I think that's kind of the first red flag for me.
Well, and for those of you who read my daily Mariners Moose Tracks at Lookout Landing, I shared an article from Sports Info Solutions a couple of days ago, which was basically outlining that he had the biggest difference last year, minimum, I think, 200 plate appearances, between expected WOBA and actual WOBA. And he, basically, the reason was that he was just making the most out of a bunch of very, like, lucky situations. For example, like his ballpark happened to feed well into his skill set. He was roping a lot of doubles, like just fair down the line. He was also using his speed to leg out a lot of like doubles that would normally be singles, because he is a pretty fast guy. But this is all to say, like, there are warning signs to his profile from last year. And I think that even if you just look at like the walk rate and K rate, you can suss that out for yourself. And if you see his second half dip off, you can see that for yourself. And this is one of many reasons why I have been banging the drum for the Mariners to like not promise him a starting spot, or to not clear a starting spot for him. I think the Mariners should still be acting as if that there is an unfilled spot in the outfield. And the reason is because I'm just simply not comfortable giving him a full season of plate appearances based on 400 plate appearances that he had last year in his breakout season, only of which, you know, the first half was really anything impressive. I'm very worried about that. But I and here's the thing. I know the Mariners aren't stupid, right? Like, I know the Mariners whatever we're talking about, the Mariners certainly know, and they have, and they know more than we do. They may see something, maybe they can fix something in his swing to like make those numbers more real for him. Maybe they can do something to cut down his K rate. Maybe they think he'll work well with Brant Brown, who they just hired. You know, there's all sorts of different variables, but I do worry about like preparing a spot in the outfield for him and thinking that that will equal Teoscar Hernandez's production, which is what they're replacing. Do you mind if, real quick, for the sake of all this conversation, if I just kind of like break down the players that are in and out for people that may not be super aware?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's been a pretty active winter. The Mariners, for those of you who haven't been like super tuned in, Jerry DePoto himself basically said that he thought in the first month of the offseason that he was going to be operating with a bigger payroll than they ended up having. There was a bunch of fallout with Root Sports. You can read all about that on the Seattle Times. Ryan Divish has done a great job with a great number of articles that are very enlightening and also very saddening about how basically the team is using the Root Sports losing money and or Comcast forcing Root Sports into a higher membership tier in terms of payment and people cord cutting. They're using this as an excuse to cut payroll for next year because of the uncertainty with their RSN, because the Mariners own Root Sports specifically, which I think is bullshit because there's so many other teams that have it way worse than the Mariners do this offseason. The Bally Sports thing has really been a big problem for a lot of teams, and yet several of those teams are still spending. But that's just, you know, Ryan Divish once again speaks on this more eloquently. But that all said, the Mariners are basically working with the same payroll they had last year. So they had a payroll of $140 million. They're projected to, according to the last article from Ryan Divish, likely start the season below that and maybe crest to $145 in season. Because, you know, if they're making trades in season, if they're calling up guys for their debuts, that will all be payroll additions that they aren't currently having on their payroll.
Oh, wait, say that all that the numbers one more time.
Yeah, so last year they ended at 140,
mm-hmm.
and this year they will likely enter just shy of that, with a crest at 145. Yeah, with a crest at 145, most likely in season, and that is because again they want to leave room for payroll additions in season. You know, when you call up a guy to make his major league debut, that's a $720,000 addition to your payroll. So if you do that 10 times, that's $7 million.
And where are we at now?
So that's a great question, and sources kind of differ on where the Mariners are right now. If you ask FanGraphs, they're projected for around 132 right now. Mean that they're about done. But Darren Gosler, who, you know, longtime reader of Lookout Landing, has done a great job tracking the payroll for the Mariners this winter, has them closer to 119. So that's obviously a big difference, right? Because 119 means they still have about $15 million to spend if they are indeed capping themselves at like 135-ish to go into the season. Whereas otherwise, you know, if Fangraphs is right, they're probably just about done, sans maybe a couple of, you know, more minor signings. And Jerry DePoto himself has said that they are probably still looking at players. He doesn't think that they're done, but language that he used makes it sound like they're not looking for like a splash. I don't think they're going to be adding a Jorge Soler or Cody Bellinger, but that's just basically my reading on it. And I've said all this as context for the moves that the Mariners made, which is, you know, they shipped Eugenio Suarez out of town for backup catcher Seve Zavala and a fireballing reliever Carlos Vargas, who really hasn't made much of anything yet. That was a cost-cutting move, very clearly. Even more so was the Jared Kelenic trade, where they sent him to Atlanta along with Evan White and Marco Gonzalez, more importantly, with their contracts, in exchange for minor league right-handed pitcher Cole Phillips, who's a prospect who has not thrown an inning yet because of injuries in minor league ball, but was once a top prospect. And Jackson Coar, also once a top prospect, now more of a big league reliever, probably going to add to their big league pile. And that was definitely a move where the Mariners paid basically the Braves by sending Jared Kelenic. That was the payment for taking on the contracts of Gonzalez and White, which helped shed around $20 million in payroll. The Mariners then started to like rejigger their roster with the newfound payroll. They added Luis Urias, which really, that actually happened before the Eugenio trade, but was seen as replacement for Eugenio at third base. They added him in a trade from Boston for right-handed reliever Isaiah Campbell. And then they also signed, importantly, their new designated hitter Mitch Garver to a two-year deal for $24 million. And that was all they had done really until last week when they made the trade we just talked about, where they traded Jose Caballero for Luke Raley. And they made a very shocking trade where they traded left-hander Robbie Ray, who was coming off Tommy John surgery, won't be available till mid-season because of that, in exchange for right-hander Anthony DeSclafani and our old friend Mitch Haniger. And that seems to be pretty much their offseason. So for those of you who are like trying to math this all out in your head, basically their third baseman was replaced, with Eugenio being replaced for Luis Urias. Teoscar is gone on free agency. He did sign with the Dodgers, so he's not coming back. They replaced him essentially with Mitch Haniger, and Luke Raley replaced Jared Kelnick, and then they have Mitch Garver now as their DH, which is really their only real surefire upgrade, because they did not really have a DH last year. I guess you could count Ford and or Murphy as the DH, and both of those guys are now out of town. And then the only other, you know, move that I haven't Sebby Zavala, the backup catcher they got, will replace Tom Murphy. And then, yes, the DeSclafani thing is, I think he's going to replace Marco Gonzalez's spot, it seems, as like a swingman type of player who will be their sixth starter slash fill-in if someone gets hurt. But that was a whirlwind of an offseason that was really quite dramatic. I mean, people online, if you've been on Twitter in the last like few months, you know it has not been a happy place to be for Mariners fans. Specifically because every other week we would get another article about this RSN crap and about how the Mariners have even less money to spend than we thought. Because back in November, DePoto said in an interview, we will likely have a payroll above last year, which was 140 again. And Ryan Divish was thinking that, and I know that he would say that this was all speculation. Ryan Divish was thinking that would likely be around 150. We now know that that's not even, or likely to not even sniff that. And the reason this is particularly frustrating, at least to me, is that the Mariners are basically shooting themselves in the foot at a moment where they could be capitalizing on the Rangers, Astros, Angels really having a quite bad offseason, or at least not doing a whole lot. The Rangers signed Tyler Mahle. The other two teams haven't done really anything to upgrade their rosters. And so this, in theory, should be an offseason where the Mariners could leapfrog those teams if they went out and they signed Cody Bellinger with all the money that they just shed, which in theory, if you think the 119 million figure is correct, they could do that without really even passing last year's payroll by a significant margin. And that's really, I think, to come back to the Luke Raley thing of it all, that is why I think the Mariners should be acting like they still have an outfield spot open. There is so much uncertainty in the corners of the outfield, and at the DH first base spot you have Mitch Garver, who the Mariners signed. He is very good. He has been a catcher. He has never been a full-time DH, except for at the end of last season. But he's had a very rough injury history, so there's that to consider. Ty France, who was bad last year, we don't know if he's going to rebound. Mitch Haniger, I'm glad he's back because he's a fun player, but we know about his injury history. And then there's Luke Raley, who we just outlined before. We are not sure if he can repeat what he did last year. And the Mariners are going to give, seemingly, starting outfield spots to both Raley and Haniger, which to me does not seem wise, given that they don't really have enough depth behind that to support that. Because behind those players, they've got Dominic Canzone, Taylor Trammell, Cade Marlowe, Zach Deloach.
I hate those options
names
so much.
You're talking about. I know. So
I think I think that segues pretty nicely into really two mailbag questions. I don't know if we can just kind of get into it at once, but Aaron Vodeman Empire asks, curious how y'all think the corner outfield playing time shakes out between Mitch, Raley, Canzone when everyone is healthy. And then Isabel asks, being relatively new to the sport, super cool, Isabel, I'd appreciate like a breakdown of what kind of strategy it looks like the M's are building towards in more depth than control the zone, which I think you actually put really nicely before we started recording.
Yeah, I do want to say, you know, to the question of what they're likely to do is, I think, different than what I want them to do. What you actually have is, I'm looking at your notes here, Mikey, the Canzone Haniger platoon is actually what I would love in right field, because I think that works really well for both players. Haniger, I think, kind of needs to be a bench player who plays maybe 3 days a week. Not only just because of his health, but because, you know, he did not have a very good season last year when he was playing. I would love to see him be like the left-handed he would hit against lefties, that is, in right field. He would get to back up at DH, especially if Garver gets hurt. He would get to back up the other outfield positions. I think that's like an ideal role for him. But what it seems like the Mariners are doing is, in the way they're talking about it, is they say they want Mitch Haniger to play as much right field as he can, which tells me that they are not short side platooning him. They are probably playing him most of the time, and maybe they'll have someone else back him up, you know, two games a week or so. That's my thinking on what they've said. It's, and then for left field, I do think it's probably gonna be Rayleigh. I think it's gonna be a battle between like Rayleigh, Canzone, Marlowe, Trammell, kind of like a redux of last year's Kelnick, Trammell, Marlowe. That is not what I would want them to do. And then to answer Isabel's question about, you know, a breakdown of the strategy and depth, it does seem like with all this and all that we're talking about, there's a lot more optionality than the Mariners often have. They usually have optionality at like DH because the Mariners have traditionally, especially since the since Nelson Cruz left the organization, they've kind of used the DH spot as like a rotating place to like give guys a little bit of rest, get some guys in the lineup that maybe wouldn't ordinarily be in the lineup, to keep like Cal Raleigh's bat in the lineup, for instance, if they want to not have his legs be suffering from catching. I think that the optionality thing is actually very smart in the versatility of the lineup. This is like what the Rays specialize in, right? Nobody on the Rays gets more than 500 plate appearances in a season unless you're like a star. And it seems like the Mariners may be kind of going to that model. The problem is that I think they need another player or two to really make it work. And that's why I think they really need another full-time outfielder. Because if they did sign someone like, you know, Jorge Soler, like Teoscar, who they can't anymore, but that would have been ideal, or Cody Bellinger, and all of a sudden you can have Rayleigh and Haniger be more bench guys who are able to rotate in when they're healthy and or when they're productive. But we know that there's going to be some problem with the lineup, that either Garver's going to get hurt, or maybe France's going to get hurt, or he's not going to be good, or, you know, somewhere in the outfield there's going to be a problem. And I just don't think they have enough solutions to make it work. I feel like they're doing a raise, but they're not, they're doing like a raise light, you know, they're not quite going for it. What do you think about all that, Mikey?
Yeah, I think I really love that. I mean, really for the first time since Nelson Cruz, and I mean, even then he played a lot of outfield up in the beginning. It feels good for them to come out and be like, this guy is going to be a DH and he's going to be the DH, you know, almost all the time, is really, really reassuring.
I'm actually kind of excited about Garver because when he plays, he's like a very good hitter.
He rakes. I love Garver. And yeah, I agree. I mean, I really want to be like in the meetings where they talk about like, all right, guys, like we're going to play Haniger 5 times a week. It's like, what? Like, I don't get how you can expect that, or like why you would think that's good for your team. But yeah, I mean, I'm the one that wrote it in the notes, but yeah, I think it'll be Rayleigh on the strong side and left field, Hanny on the strong side of the platoon and right field. And, you know, I think I've seen people talk about Canzone. Maybe I dreamt this. I don't know why it's always so unclear. But
you're sick in the head.
I am. But I think I saw that people think Canzone might be just get like full-time reps in AAA.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't agree with that. Especially because our options are so weak.
I actually really like Canzone. I actually have some faith that he could become a pretty good player and would like him to be on the strong side of a platoon to start the season. But the one worry I have is that his outfield defense is terrible. It's like Jesse Winker-esque. Dare I invoke that name? And they can't DH him because they just signed a DH. So I do worry a little bit about that, but he has an interesting profile where he does control the zone like they love. Mm-hmm. And his ISO numbers in the minors were so good that, like, I wonder if he can just tap into some power if he can't be, like, you know, a solid like 115, 120 WRC plus player. Like, that's my dream for Canzone.
I mean, I don't know if you listened to the episode when we acquired him, but I obviously didn't love what it took to acquire him. But his batted ball numbers were really, really encouraging. To that point, like, I think his numbers might have not been great, but just the underlying, you know, stuff, he can really impact the ball. And he didn't really do much of anything with us, but I remain optimistic about him. I think I have kind of soured a little bit just because he did nothing, but I think it's really just hindsight bias.
Yeah.
So I'm a fan too.
He did the opposite of what Josh Rojas did, where like Rojas came in, I thought he wasn't going to do anything, and he ended up being pretty good.
Mm-hmm. I love Rojas.
Don't forget that he hates you, though, because we have the evil Josh Rojas voice on this podcast.
I forgot about that. shouts out to Day. Yeah, to speak to Isabel's question, too, because we're, again, talking about this pre-pod, and the way that Durst put it is, so looking at of all, you know, hitters with 100 plate appearances or more last year, the Mariners have six hitters with a K percentage 30% or higher.
Right.
Almost all those guys are gone now. So Dylan Moore's probably going to play a lot, but hopefully, you know, mostly against left-handed hitters, which, you know, he breaks against. Marlowe, again, going to be pretty limited probably. Mike Ford's now gone. Jared Kelnick's now gone. Teoscar Hernandez is now gone. And Eugenio Suarez is now gone. So, you know, that's really like, that kind of just leaves Dylan Moore as like the lone guy that strikes out a lot. Then, you know, you introduce Luke Raley. That's pretty much it. So when, you know, we talked about this, and I think, you know, Durs, when you were on the pod too, we've talked a lot about the Mariners really struggle to move runners along because they strike out a lot. They're, you know, home run, walk, strikeout guys, like maybe not true three outcome, but you know, they're not. And honestly, I was kind of surprised to hear the Mariners come out and be like, yeah, we're trying to cut down the strikeout rate as well. Because to some extent you just want good hitters, which, you know, the Mariners have and have not had. But to speak to Isabel's question, like they, I think, are getting more towards that control the zone mentality. And I know that's kind of, Isabel, what you're not wanting out of this question, but I think what we're going to see a lot more of is them putting the ball in play, because Mitch Haniger also doesn't swing and miss very much. And actually,
right,
to really quickly speak to the kind of expected numbers, if you're looking at ex-WOBA from Alex Chamberlain's leaderboard that folds in spray, rather than, I think it's 36 points overperforming, Luke Raley actually only overperformed by 10 points. And then Mitch Haniger, like his spray ex-WOBA was 342, which is way higher than his WOBA of 277. So again, I think the underlying numbers there are pretty solid. And so I think with Haniger, you know, you have someone who's going to come in and swing and miss a lot less and strike out a lot less. Luis Urias, you know, strikes out maybe 20% of the time, like really doesn't swing and miss at all. It's going to be like, we're going to watch a much different baseball. So, you know, it might not be better, but it's going to look different. We're actually going to see more batted balls in play. Just, you know, hopefully it's not them rolling over.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people have, I think, rightly asked the question, did the Mariners really want to cut down on strikeouts, or was that just like something they said as an excuse to cut these guys who are making a lot of money? Because it just so happened that their highest strikeout guys were also their highest paid players. So when you look at Teoscar, you look at Eugenio, I do think, though, that there is something to it. And the reason is because you look at, like, you know, they did not have to trade Kelnick. They did not have to let go of Mike Ford. They did not have to let Tom Murphy go. Like, those guys were not necessarily expensive. And I also think that we saw so much frustration from Scott Servais in interviews last year, like after games, where he would just like talk about how the team did not follow the game plan offensively that was laid out for them that day. And we saw so many non-competitive at-bats. I'm looking at you, Teoscar Hernandez, like the king of like the three pitch at-bat where he just like swings and misses at three pitches.
Honestly.
And that's the end of it. And that's, yeah, he was a good player, but like how hard to watch was that, right? And I'm sure from the manager's perspective, you watch that and you're like, he did not do anything that we like talked about in the pregame meeting. And I think that like acquiring Haniger, for example, is like the antithesis of that. Like we talked about this on the Meet the Mitt podcast, like Haniger is like, he is known for like following the game plan, being very attuned to like what the pitcher is throwing that day. And I think that that's kind of what they're looking for more, is they're trying to get a group of guys who will like follow the plan of attack. Because if you have a group of guys who are just kind of like doing their own thing out there, it's very hard to like make the team better in season. It's very hard to like rally people around the cause of like, okay, let's get on the same page here. And I also think that that's one of the reasons why they brought in Brant Brown, who was the Marlins hitting coach last year. Got a lot of praise for kind of helping Jorge Soler have a great season last year. Very respected hitting coach. They hired him as bench coach and a new role title called offensive coordinator, which they say he will not replace the hitting coach. Jarrett DeHart is still the hitting coach. But what Brant Brown's role will be is designing the in-game strategy for the team, game-to-game strategy. So he'll be the one like coming up with a game plan each day and relaying that to the players. And I do think that based on what we saw last season, that is very much needed. And I think you're kind of right that we're going to see a different style of Mariners baseball that they hope is more aligned with like attacking the pitcher's weaknesses or attacking, you know, it's basically just more directed than it was last year. And that may or may not be better or worse, because you're talking about, you know, you just want good offensive players. Like Cleveland famously does not strike out ever. They had a team WRC plus of 94 last year. They were not a good offensive team just because they didn't strike out. It takes a little bit more than that.
I gotta say, that's a really fascinating tidbit that I had not thought about. And I think like when you think of those types, like Tom Murphy's one of the most intense, you know, and I think Kyle Raleigh too is known for the kind of game planning and just dedication to the pregame kind of stuff. Really the only example of a player, at least that I know of, that has moved on that runs counter to that. But I also think it has to do with the fact that Tom Murphy only played 47 games last year and he raked, but he also, you know, it's right. Every season he starts to, I don't know, he's just super hot at the plate. He hits like 4 home runs in a week. And then you find out he's been playing with something and he hurts it and whatever. And I think the merit, like, I don't know what, I truly have no idea what they see in Sebi Zafala, but
they see a warm body who can hold the fort until Harry Ford is ready.
That's pretty much it. And you don't really need, you know, like, I don't know. You have Kyle Raleigh, who I was shocked to see posted 4.7 WAR, like, who's going to play most times of the week, and Sebi can fill in here and there. So,
and I'm nervous about that, because I think that one of the biggest problems the Mariners had last year and the year before was that they don't have anyone who can like confidently take Cal Raleigh's spot. Like, because that they're shoving Cal Raleigh into the lineup 6 games a week, and because they don't have the DH spot to now give him, they're just going to be forced to put him at catcher all the time, because they're so afraid of like not having a reliable backup. And when Murphy was healthy, we saw Raleigh got to sit a little bit more, which is good for him and his health and the longevity of the season. And I worry that with Zavala as the guy back there, that they're going to feel like pressured / encouraged to just like let Raleigh play until his legs fall off. And I worry what that does to his production at the plate, and what that does to like the long-term health as the season wears on. And that is why I'm hoping, you know, I'm hoping we do see Harry Ford toward the end of the year. I'm thinking we may not, just because he's a catcher and he's still like 20 years old and he is going to start at Double-A next year. And you usually want to give those guys some more time to develop. But I would love it if they somehow found a way to acquire just a more competent offensive player that can back up Raleigh.
Do you want to hear the most like simple brained take that I have in terms of philosophy?
Go for it.
I think that the Mariners want to raise their batting average, and I'm not kidding. I'm really not, you know, like think about the Mariners.
Okay. I mean, we've been doing it for the last like 30 minutes, but go on.
Okay. I'm just going to list all the players that batted below 250. Cade Marlowe at 239, Suarez at 232, Raleigh at 232, Ford at 228, Caballero at 221, Canzone at 215, Dylan Moore at 207, Pollock at 173, and Colton Wong at 165. Like, how many of those players are still around? Marlowe hardly counts. Raleigh, Canzone, Moore. And again, like, looking at it this way, I'm kind of like, I wonder if this is one reason why they're moving on from Caballero, which isn't to say that Luke Raley's got the highest batting average. What did he bat last year? 249. But yeah, like, I just, if you have good hitters, I think you need to be able to move them along. And Luis Urias, like, he hasn't run a high batting average either, but he'll be on the higher end of those, you know, that group of players. And
yeah, he's a bounce back candidate.
Yeah. And I'm interested, like, do you think the Mariners are getting the 2021 to 2022 version of him with Milwaukee, or do you think they're getting the 2023 version? And mind you, if I remember correctly, he was injured last year. I also might not be remembering that correctly. So
I do want to say, first of all, to your take about the Mariners and batting average, like, I do think they're smarter than that. Like, I actually firmly believe that Jerry DePoto is an above average general manager with a below average, like, payroll to work with. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing, is that if you're working with the payroll he's working with, you have to be right way more often than you're wrong to pan out with the outcomes that the Mariners have gotten the last couple of years. So I do think that they're smarter than just like, oh, like, batting average number good, let's make that higher. I do think that that's kind of a product of, like, getting a more contact oriented team.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what you and were alluding to.
Yeah. And I don't even mean it as, like, I think that the Mariners are looking at batting average and, you know, like, that's what they're, but I think when you think about all these stats, like, I see in this row average, OBP, slugging, WOBA, XWOBA, WRC plus, like, out of those, how are you going to move runners along? You know, it's, I mean, I guess all of them, but the one that is just like, you are getting on base, you are at least hitting a single and, you know, moving a runner by two bases, probably that's the way. So yeah, I don't even mean that as like a slight or as like a, this is what the Mariners are doing, but like, I think you can look at their team and because, you know, we talked about this a lot, like, you know, they were so streaky. Like, they were actually a pretty good hitting team last year, but they're so streaky that there are games where, you know, they won't score a run for multiple games and then they'll score 11.
Yeah.
And it's because they're,
which doesn't no good.
No.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, the team that they're moving towards philosophically and just how the kind of sequencing will work, I think fits in better with the roster that you've constructed. Like, it's easier, I think, to get a small lead and to hold it with your pitching staff than, you know, to be behind, like, I don't know, 1-4 and hope that Cal Raleigh hits a grand slam.
I will say that the Mariners' current lineup, as currently projected, every player in that lineup is projected for a WRC plus of 100 or better, which is average or better, except for Josh Rojas, who I actually would take the over on. But the point is, I think that what they've done is they've created a lineup that, to your point, like, there are no gaping holes in that lineup. There's nobody who, like, comes up and you're like, ah, that's an automatic out right there. And I think that's kind of what they're hoping for, is that they just want to make sure that the lineup is competent and competitive enough throughout. And to be honest with you, we haven't even talked about this, and I think the reason is because it's such a sure thing. The pitching staff is so good. Like, this pitching staff might be the best pitching staff in baseball, and it wouldn't surprise me. And if that's the case, all they need to be a contender is an average lineup. And we spend so much time hand-wringing about how the lineup isn't great, but, like, if the pitching staff is great, the lineup doesn't need to be amazing. It can be average to maybe slightly above. If, you know, if everyone meets their projections and everyone hits about 100 WRC plus, or, you know, in the case of, like, Julio or Raleigh or JP, hopefully a little bit more than that, this team will be very good, even if they have refused to spend money as they should. And that's part of the reason why it's so frustrating, is because, like, go get Cody Bellinger and you're an AL West contender. But I do want to talk about Urias, because you prompted me with that. I do believe that Urias can get back to his 2021-2022 level production. He is still quite young. He's 26, right? He is still in his prime. This is not a guy who's, like, aged out of being good. I do think that you can't always just, like, wave off a season because of injury, but I do think that, like, he only had 200 plate appearances. He was hurt. I do think that, like, you can put a red flag next to that season, or an asterisk of sorts next to that season, and be like, I don't know if I believe all the data that's coming out of this. In the same way that you could for Mitch Haniger's season last year with San Francisco, because the numbers under the hood for him were actually quite good, even though he had bad results. And so I do think that Urias is kind of a smart guy to acquire, and honestly, I do see the sense in, like, Eugenio is getting older. I understand that. I heard somewhere, and I'm sorry that I can't credit the person for saying this, because, like, this is not my original idea, but, like, the numbers for Eugenio Suarez were not looking good at the end of the year under the hood. Like, his exit velos were down. He was not producing with the same kind of power and oomph that you're expecting from him. And I think that there's some age-related concerns with that. And with the contract that he had, they may have figured, okay, let's get a guy who's younger, who is closer to his peak, who could, in theory, produce the same level. And in fact, Steamer does have Urias, and Suarez is basically even in projected value this year. So I do think that Urias will not probably be the Suarez that we're used to seeing, because what that means is that Suarez is going to dip off from the last couple of years. But I do think that Urias can be competent enough to, you know, not embarrass the team out there. Well, my concern is that, like, Urias is your starting third baseman and Rojas is your starting second baseman, and neither of those guys do I feel super confident about, especially when you have all those question marks elsewhere in the diamond, you know, in the outfield at DH at first base. I do wish that they would get someone, like, you know, people have talked about Jorge Polanco as, like, a guy they could get. I know that the Marlins are dangling Luis Urias, although I will say I think that would cost more than people realize, prospect-wise. So I kind of wonder. The Mariners have spoken about wanting to get an infielder specifically. They haven't really talked about wanting to get another outfielder, but I think that the kind of infielder they might be willing to get is, like, a Donovan Solano, a Whit Merrifield. I don't think it's going to be sexy, but I do think they need some depth there, because what if Urias is bad? And now all of a sudden you need to fill that hole. And, you know, I don't really want Dylan Moore playing every day to fill in for that.
Do you remember that one time he played third base?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I do think that, and this is the case at a couple positions, the Mariners have a couple of very good prospects that they, you know, and I will give them credit for this too. Like, they built this roster that they built that I do think will be pretty good and could be, and probably will be, a contender without trading any of their, like, major pieces away from the farm. Like, Cole Young, Harry Ford, Tyler Locklear. These are all guys who will probably play at some point this year. Maybe not for Young and Ford, depending on, you know, they're pretty young. But I do think they're, like, in some senses saving some space for them. Like, I don't think they want to sign. If you trade for Urias, for example, then, like, Cole Young doesn't necessarily have a spot to play in when he comes up at the end of this year, or beginning of next year. And I think they're quite high on him. And I know that the old idiom is, like, you don't save a spot for a prospect, but I just don't necessarily think that's true. Like, I do think that to some extent you do have to account for the fact that you will have a guy come up, and what will you do when that guy comes up? This is what every team does this, right? Depending on how high they are on a prospect.
All right. So
what
bad.
I worry about is, like,
I need
I'm
him
sure
so
you do,
bad.
But I plugged in, like, I went to the trade value simulator, and it would take, like, Harry Ford plus Michael Arroyo to get him, which I just don't think they want to stomach that kind of a cost for a guy who, in theory, Cole Young could fill that spot and be, like, I think that they believe Cole Young could be, like, as good as Arias, you know, in his prime. I don't know if they're willing to do that. So,
yeah,
I do worry about the infield. I do worry about third base, second base. I wish they get another guy, even if it's, like, a Merrifield or Solano. I really wish they get, like, a surefire guy, but I do understand that if you're not going to spend any money, which I'm very frustrated about, then, like, I understand wanting to hang on to these prospects who you're very high on. And to the point that we've talked about earlier with, like, contact, like, those guys are very good like for plate discipline, they have really good contact numbers. They don't chase. They have great contact percentage. Like, these are the kinds of players they're trying to build around. I don't think they want to let them go.
You know, it's fucked up because we just, you know, we're having a very long conversation about the Seattle Mariners roster. And like, I don't know, J.P. Crawford's going to hit like 210. And then, I don't know.
Oh, boy. It is precarious, right? Like, I said this this was definitely true last season. It's still true this season. Like, a Julio injury would ruin this team. And I mean, and that's true for a lot of teams. Like, would an Ohtani injury, well, it probably wouldn't hurt the Dodgers. I don't know. I found a better example. A Judge injury would really hurt the Yankees, right? Like, that is true for a lot of teams. But I'm very worried at how, like, we are balancing on the head of a pin on, like, the like health and production of those of the big three hitters in the lineup right now, which is Julio, Raleigh, and JP.
I mean, it's basically a Stars and Scrubs, you know, kind of setup as is. They're really passionate together. I want to know, given what you know today, or actually, I don't want to. Well, I do want to know, but Meowmix also wants to know, if this offseason ended today, what grade would you give it? And I think you know, I want to add to that.
Go ahead.
What specific addition or two would you want to see that, like, you know, that's reasonable?
Yeah, I think the reasonable thing is the tough one. I saw on ESPN, I forget, was it David Schoenfield who like graded every team's offseason? I think it was, because he's a Seattle guy. So I think he was being unnecessarily hard on the Mariners, but he gave the Mariners an F. And here's the thing. I think there's two different questions, because I do think that if you're talking about the PR perspective, like how fans feel about this franchise compared to where they felt in October, it is definitely an F. Like 54% of it all, they traded off like a bunch of fan favorite players to cut payroll. They cried poor, you know, after hosting the All-Star game. After announcing a bunch of park upgrades and like upgrades in the neighborhood that Safe or T-Mobile Park is in, like it is an F from a PR perspective. Like there's no way around it. But I think from if you're like a robot who's looking at it purely from a did they make this team better in 2024, I think it's a C minus.
Mm. What grade do I think, Durs?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I said this at some point, like months and months ago, but because I think a lot of people are like, oh God, like this guy, this guy's a Jerry DePoto stan.
and you know what's funny is I've been accused of both. I've been really? Accused of like carrying water for him, and I've also been accused of like being overly negative in this both yeah. things this offseason. And I think the reason is because like nothing is ever black and white, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that DePoto is a good general manager. I also think that this has been a bad offseason.
Well, I think the thing that I feel like I do a pretty good job of separating is just what, you know, the conditions that he's operating, you know, within. And I think he does a pretty good job of that. So I don't know, like with the grades are just kind of dumb because it's like, do you fold that in or is it just like what is transpiring? Right. But I think, yeah, I don't even know if I can dip into the B grade. I think I would call it like a C plus maybe. Yeah. Yeah. If it ended today, especially I would feel very unsatisfied, I guess. And to answer the question I asked you, I would like to see them get an outfielder that probably hits from the right side or at least just hits well against lefties. And man, it would be cool to have just another bat that is pretty much literally anywhere.
Yeah.
So
I mean, Cody Bellinger is and remains my dream. And he also like controls the zone very well. You look at his plate discipline
numbers,
doesn't
strike out.
Like, very impressive.
Yeah.
Doesn't strike out. Like he's pretty much built for T-Mobile Park because he's got a sweet left-handed swing that can like park it over the, you know, Griffey's mm-hmm. porch or whatever you want to call it mm-hmm. in right field. And he can back up Julio in center field if, like, God forbid something happens to Julio.
He's gonna get so much money, though.
That's the thing. It's like, we're dealing with Scott Boras. the Mariners are not the type to get into a bidding war. Like, when was the last time the Mariners got into a bidding war for a free agent? Robinson Cano, which was a different regime and a different ownership group. So I don't think that Bellinger's really realistic. Here's what I'll say about payroll, by the way, that I haven't said before. I do think that DePoto probably, you know, has like a break glass in case of emergency. Like, if he really believes in a player, I bet he could talk Stanton into forking over the money for. You do not believe this? Because I think that this is something I've felt deeply, that like, if DePoto like felt really strongly about a player, he would have the cachet to like get this guy.
I guess I'm just picturing it. It's like a cartoon. Like, I'm just like, I just am picturing DePoto being like, oh fuck, man.
but then on the other hand, like, what is Ohtani if not that? Especially for DePoto, who we know loved Ohtani.
I mean,
like, he could not
shit,
even get them in the conversation for him.
Yeah, but that was like 70 so, mil. I don't, maybe,
yeah, it's true. So maybe shit's I'm, crazy. You know, the other thing is, like, we don't know how that conversation went. Like, for all we know, like, they called Ohtani and Ohtani said, I'm not interested in Seattle, sorry. And that's the end of the conversation. And, like, they never had the chance to get in the race.
Yeah. Fuck, man.
But anyway, I do think that DePoto, like, I think he's very risk averse. And that doesn't help when you have, you know, a payroll that isn't, you know, helping matters.
Yeah.
I think that if DePoto was like, Cody Bellinger is my fucking guy, then I think he's earned at least the right to go to ownership and say, like, I have done so much with this roster with so little. Please just give me this one guy because he's going to help our team. But that said, I don't think he believes in Cody Bellinger.
I just thought of a.
I just do personally.
I just thought of a title for this episode.
Oh boy, I'm scared.
Man, he really is my boy. I like, in my head, he strikes out upper 20% of the time, 30% of the time. No, it's like sub 20, I think.
Yeah, let me look. I think it's like 17.
Just don't celebrate.
He strikes out 15 last
year. Yeah,
15
dude.
Last year.
The expected stuff is a little worrying, but still, like, I don't know. Just at least give me Soler. Just give me Soler, please.
Do you want Soler patrolling the outfield?
I don't
and
care.
And Canzone?
I don't care.
Well, I don't know if it's Canzone.
I really don't think Canzone's that bad.
Okay. I mean, he's young. He could get better.
So, okay.
I think he's really bad. I'm sorry.
That's fair. Let me look up his outs above average and then ask you a couple questions and we can wrap this bad boy up. Okay. Do you want me to gloat about, sorry, we haven't recorded for months. Do you want me to gloat about Marco having been traded now or at the end of the podcast?
Okay, I want you to comment because this just dropped today, like an hour before you and I are recording, and you probably know exactly what I'm going to ask you about.
I do.
That Marco Gonzalez Driveline Baseball posted a video of Marco Gonzalez at Driveline, and he's like jack hopping and throwing into a wall like 2 inches in front of him, and he's like grunting like so loud, and it's like 90, 91.
It's so embarrassing. I mean,
and everyone's like, oh, he hit 94. Consider the circumstances of him hitting 94.
I think
one time.
I think this is what he needed. He needed a kick in the pants to try and actually throw a velo because he's, you know, he's like, oh, I'm a pitcher. I'm a real lunch pail guy. Like, I don't need velo to be successful. It's like, I don't know that that's true, Marco, but go off, King.
I want you to what do you make anything of that, basically, is my question for you.
I mean, I think he might get to, like, it just doesn't really matter unless he's able to sit. I'm trying to remember where he was at. So the first article I ever wrote that I got paid for was a Marco Gonzalez article. And a lot of it was, you know, it was just that, like, I made the case that he's very good and comped him to metrically at that point. It was like James Paxton and like another pitcher. And he lost Vila over the course of that season. And I was just very like, what do you call it? Like starry eyed back then. So I was like, oh, I think he gets his Vila back and I think he's going to be an ace or something. And, I think
it was pretty good. He had like two, four win seasons.
Yeah.
So, like, good for him.
I mean, he, like, was legitimately like good. But he was sitting probably 92, 93, maybe 94 at the beginning of that season. And I think unless he gets to probably 93
sitting, right? Not
touching. Yeah. Like, it's just not going to be that. It's just going to be the Marco that we've known, you know, for several years. So I'm just like, good on you for actually trying now to throw harder. But yeah, I'm just like, I swear I don't hate him, but I kind of do.
I don't either, but he also can't hurt me because he's in Pittsburgh.
It's so true.
Like, even if he has like a 4-win season, like, good for you, kid. That's not doing anything to the Mariners.
Yeah, I was really bummed for Kelnick to be gone and Evan White. But the relief of like, A, I don't have to watch Marco pitch or think about him taking up innings. B, I don't have to just have the stress of like Jared Kelnick not doing it. And C, I don't have to think about the same thing with Evan White, but really just staying healthy.
There's not like, I feel like last 2 spring trainings, there have been like 4 players coming in that I've just been so nervous about. And I don't feel that way right now, which is maybe an indication that they had a good offseason. But like, there aren't players where I'm like,
yeah,
oh man, I really hope he comes in healthy. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that alone is going to help out the team a lot. But wow, I just realized we didn't really get into a lot of the pitchers, which is fine.
I was hoping to have you talk about a couple of them. Is that still okay? Like, I do think that people want to hear your thoughts on specifically, like, do you have any thoughts on Carlos Vargas or Jackson Coar or Mauricio Yovera or any of the minor league guys that they signed? Are there any of those guys that, like, you're really specifically interested in? Because I think people want to know about that.
Yovera in particular, like, I actually really love. Very low release. I think he throws from, like, 5.2, 5.3 feet. Which is, I'm trying to think of a comp. It's very low and low release. I mean, it's hard to throw a bad fastball when you throw from that low. Throws a really, you know, good sinker. I think that's probably his best pitch right now. Has a hard cutter. I think he throws it like 91 and then a sweeper. I think the sinker is going to be a really, really good pitch. And, you know, we know that the Mariners love sinkers. The sweeper mirrors it perfectly, and I think that the cutter could be a good bridge pitch. But
so that's like kind of like Castillo as a reliever, right? Like Luis Castillo as a reliever.
It's not dissimilar. I would say, shit, there's probably a Mariners reliever that comps to him pretty well. I don't know. Like, that's not like Munoz. Like, I don't know. But I think the sinker is going to be a good strike throwing pitch. I think that it's going to, you know, deaden really the exit velos of like of hitters. And I think it just comes down to, can you throw the sweeper for strikes enough? And can, like, kind of the brash thing, like, can guys just spit on the sweeper because it's so big and it's not a sinker, you know, which is really the role that the cutter plays here. So just throw that enough. At least, like, theoretically, that's how it works, but it doesn't always shake out that way. But he in particular, I'm really excited about and think that he's going to slot in nicely into, you know, the latter kind of innings over time.
Interesting. I want to know, do you have any thoughts specifically on Anthony Desclafani? Because we haven't really talked about him, but he is in theory going to fill that, like, innings eater Marco role. He had rough season last year, but he has been pretty good in the past. Do you think the Mariners can do anything with him, or is he just like a warm body to throw out there if like someone goes down?
I actually really like him. It's also really funny because I've known that he exists for for many, many years, probably 5 years, and in my head, lefty. Like, just a lefty. Maybe I get him mixed up with...
my God, I do this with players, too.
Yeah, I think, like, it's maybe because of Tony Cingrani.
Oh, yep, that's a lefty. I always think Sandy Alcantara is a lefty.
Not. Yeah, super not.
No, I know. Cy Young winner, I get it wrong.
Yeah. So, yeah, most left-handed name ever, I would say. I think comfortable saying that. He's from Staten Island. It's not true. Yeah, I think just really good depth. And I don't think that we can really rely on him as a starter if something is to happen to Wu or Miller. I feel like in particular, but I think something could happen to anyone.
Yeah.
But I think with some pitch mix tweaks, which I think is like going to be the thing that happens, he could actually be really sneaky because his changeup's not good and his curveball's not good, which basically leaves him with, you know, a fastball, sinker, slider, if I remember correctly. And I think that's fine, especially if he's not going 5-6 innings. But I think, like, man, what a perfect guy to have as your swingman rather than like Flexen, I guess, or Marco or whatever. Oh, so yeah. I'm actually a really big fan of this move. At first was just like, man, this is such a, you know, brand name ass trade with like not a lot of good stuff happening, but think that they can contribute in ways that I'm starting to do some video stuff for the Giants, and was looking into Ray and was like, man, there's not like a clear cutoff for when his fastball starts to get more whiffs or when it starts to induce weaker contact. So I'm like, I don't know what was going to happen with Ray.
I remember being way too locked in day to day on what his velocity was. And I'm very glad I don't have to worry about that anymore, because I remember being like, oh, if he's not sitting 95, he's going to be crap today.
It's like Felix again.
I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. One more, if I can lightning round one more pitcher question for you, because I think people probably want to hear about this also. Have you seen anything about Bryce Miller's developing a splitter?
Yeah. Let me pull up the numbers. I think the rule and thumb for me, did I say rule and thumb? The rule of thumb for me is just not to trust off-season splitter stuff. So I guess that is what I'm going to say here. You know, for God, where's the screenshot where it shows his, the numbers. So
he posted it today. Yeah.
83 miles per hour. He's getting the spin under 1,000. Induced vertical break is -6, which is like huge movement. And then 10 inches of fade. Yeah, I think it looks nasty, and I think you just have to throw a splitter enough for pitchers. I'm kind of wording that incorrectly. You have to throw a splitter like robustly enough to where hitters are like not just have some like it in their mind, I think, but like they're expecting it. And I don't think he's gonna do that. So like even Logan Gilbert, who I should write about soon, threw a nasty splitter 15% of the time. His fastball still wasn't very good. It decreased in efficacy despite really all of his secondaries taking a step forward. So all that is to say, unless Miller can throw the splitter 20-25% of the time, which like really what I should look at is against left-handed hitters, how much is Gilbert throwing it? 17%? So like unless he gets to like 20-25 against lefties, I don't know that it's going to do that much for him. I could be very wrong, but like the theory is much like that of a gyro slider with a splitter. It's like it looks like a fastball and it drops off the table, and if you can locate it well enough, like the symbiotic relationship that the two have back and forth, it should, you know, help the fastball play up, which was his only weapon last year, really. So excited about the tweaks that he's making in particular, because I think he really needs it. But I think a splitter more than most is a pitch that I don't count on, you know, in the offseason going into the next season.
The one thing that I will say I'm worried about with Bryce Miller is that he dealt with some blister issues last year throughout the season, and a splitter will certainly not help that, right? Because pitchers get splitters pretty, or get blisters pretty often when they throw splitters a lot. So I'm a little bit worried about him taking up that pitch specifically, given his like already existing blister issues.
Yeah, and I wonder like what fingers and like areas he dealt with it. But yeah, like I know that Kevin Gausman literally doesn't
practice
his splitter. Like he just he just throws it in game. Like, that's the only time.
And it's, he's really good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a tough pitch. And I think there's a reason why the Mariners are throwing or having pitcher, or I don't know, you know, if it's an org thing, but I don't think it's a coincidence that so many Mariners are trying it out. So it's like, yeah, if it takes, it could change shit for him. But I think there's a reason why guys, you know, have gone away from it over the years as well. So kind of mixed on it, but the numbers are nasty. Like six, that negative 6 inches of induced vertical break is like, that's like curveball numbers. It's kind of wild.
Yeah. I mean, it all comes down to, with everything, can he command it? Right. Cause if he can't command it, then this is all moot and we're going to see it like 3 pitches a game. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. So I don't know. I think the kind of, I posted this in the Slack already, but the takeaway for me, you know, just in making that list of like, here's who we've added, here's who we've subtracted, positionally, you know, I look at the team and I think not having to experience all of it like day by day and just look at it, I'm like, yeah, this is kind of annoying. Like it's an annoying way to build a roster. It feels very Guardians A's-esque. There's probably another team that I can think of, but it's
Rays.
Yeah, but it's not bad.
No, I do feel, like I said before, I do think that this team can be like an 88-90 win team. And I think that we're probably going to see projections probably close to around like 85-86 when like Pocota comes out. Partially because the division has gotten so much worse. Like the Angels are terrible now. I'm still waiting for the Angels to sign someone. For example, I think it'd be the funniest thing if they signed Blake Snell, because I do not trust them with pitchers. And I also don't trust Blake Snell to do what he did last year. So I think that would just be a catastrophe all around.
Yeah.
It's insanely funny to me that they in the end ended up with Evan White. We're never gonna see that man on the face of the earth ever again. I feel bad for him, but like that is not a place he should be.
No.
The Angels are gonna be terrible. The A's are gonna be terrible. The Rangers and Astros are gonna be pretty good, but like I'm not so sure that they're going to be significantly better than the Mariners next year. Probably more than the Astros, especially if the Rangers, like, I don't know if you've seen how many of their guys are expected back in the second half, their pitchers. They have like Scherzer, they have DeGrom, they have Molly, like all those guys. They're gonna have a brand new rotation in the second half, and it could be pretty scary.
It's so wild. Yeah. Oh, Molly?
Yeah. They signed Tyler Molly.
What? When?
This like in December.
What the fuck? I love him. Damn it. Okay. That's good to know.
But he's missing, like, I think he's hurt for the first half of the year too.
Oh, so, yeah. Okay. Weird. Well, shots out.
Anyway.
All right. Well, Durs, let's see. How do we do this thing? I got to outro us.
Not my problem.
I hate hosting. I'm not good at it. Anyways.
What if you just like clicked end the podcast? Cause nobody cares about the end anyway.
It's kind of true. Okay. Honestly, y'all know where to find me on Twitter. Durs, why don't you just plug your stuff and you can say thank you for listening and go Mariners.
I am at Anders Jorstad on Twitter. You can also find my stuff at Lookout Landing and also at the Meet at the Mitt podcast, where I record weekly during the season and like probably, you know, a couple times a month during the off season. But yeah, thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for having me. And thank you for listening to It's Never Sunny in Seattle. Go Mariners.